books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and this week it's been recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Today's show features a book by Gareth Brown called The Book of Doors. If you could open a door to anywhere, where would you go? Although some doors should never be opened. The book is a fantasy set in the present day. Although Gareth did mention it can't be a fantasy because there isn't a map at the start. We'll hear from the talk chaired by Teddy Jameson later. But for now, the audio version of The Book of Doors is read by Miranda Raisin.
Cassie's brain did a backflip and asked her what her eyes were playing at. Then her mouth fell open in disbelief. There was a world where her apartment hallway should have been. There was cool air and moisture and the slightly damp, fresh smell of a different place. There was darkness, but darkness closer to light than the snow-filled darkness of New York City. In front of her, in the bakery she had visited during those days in Venice, a light came on, punching a hole into the drizzly night. She watched as a man moved about inside, a blurred figure beyond the rain-streaked window, and she realized that this wasn't a picture she was looking at. This was moving. This was real.
Good afternoon, everyone. How are you all doing? Are you well? Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming today to the special event sponsored by RNIB Connect Radio with our guest, Gareth Brown. My name is Teddy Jameson. I'm a freelance writer. I write for The Herald, Sunday Post, Nutmeg Magazine, whoever will have me, basically. And it's a real joy. It's always a pleasure to be back in Wigtown and real pleasure to kind of talk about this book, which we're going to talk about today. But before I do that and before I introduce Gareth properly, I want to do a thought experiment with you. Are you up for that? Good, good. Right, okay. I want you to imagine a door. Any door you like. Front door, back door, the door of the building. Okay? You got that in your head? I want you to open that door, walk through, and you're somewhere else in the world. Anywhere you fancy. Paris, Prague, St. Petersburg, I don't know, Barcelona, Bilbao, whatever. New York, Newton Stewart, if you want. I mean, it's allowed. Now, imagine I tell you that there's a book that can let you do that. A book that lets you make every door a portal. No more overcrowded trains, no more airport security. You just walk through a door. Now, that's the kind of gift you want for Christmas, isn't it? That's better than a Marks & Spencer's pullover, I would say. And that's what Cassie is given at the start of Gareth's book, The Book of Doors. She immediately goes to Venice, I think is the first place she goes to. Yeah, why would you not? The problem is that gift comes with some strings attached because, you know, the Marks & Spencer pullover, you know, you might like it, but no one else is going to be that bothered about it. Let's face it. The Book of Doors, if you're given that, I think quite a few other people might be interested in that. And Cassie learns that actually there are quite a lot of people interested in that, and not all of them are the nicest of people, it has to be said. There's some real unsavory characters who quite fancy stealing it from her. That's the kind of premise. It's a lovely, simple, seductive notion that begins The Book of Doors. It's a fantastic book. It's full of mystery, magic, surprise, suspense. It's a book about booksellers and bookselling, a book about Times Square and time travel. It's about... It's got a castle, a Scottish castle, hidden in shadows, literally. And it's got some monsters, proper monsters in human form, I have to say. It's also a book about family, friendship and love. And actually, at the end of it, I think those are the things you'll remember about it. Gareth, our guest, has written it. This is his debut novel. He's been writing since he was a kid, basically, I think. So this is some culmination of that. So it's fantastic that he's achieved it. It's also even more fantastic that he's achieved it while having a day job, a proper grown-up job. He's been in the civil service for 20-odd years, I think, Gareth?
Yeah, I'm very old, yeah.
And he's currently director of screening for the NHS Scotland, which is a proper grown-up thing to be doing. So why he's writing books about fantasy and things, well, let's find out that. Would you please give the warmest of Wigtown welcomes to our guest, Gareth Brown?
Thank you.
Thanks for coming, Garth. I mean, listen, let's start with the thought experiment. You're going through the door. Not right now, because that would be a bit awkward if you disappeared for a... But where are you going to go?
Well, I suppose it's like you said, it's not, I just love to travel, but I hate being on planes and I hate airports. So anywhere that I want to go that's a nice place to visit. My wife's from Malaysia, so we could pop back to Malaysia and see her family and have some nice food, or pop to New York or Tokyo. I love big cities, as it's probably obvious for anybody who's read the book. So just to be able to go from my bedroom somewhere fantastic without having to go through an airport or sit 8 hours on a flight, that would be a dream for me, anywhere.
And was that the kind of, what was the origin of the idea? Have you, was there a particular door that kind of conjured up something for you?
I'd had the idea for a long time, actually, this sort of device of a book that can turn any door into every door. But I'd always imagined it as a sort of a thing for a proper fantasy novel, you know, wizards and dragons and such like. But I don't really read a lot of true fantasy, so I never really did anything with it. And it was during COVID when I was stuck in my wee room working, and I just, I wish I could go on holiday, and you can't travel anywhere, obviously. Yeah. So the idea came back to me, what about this book? Or what if I put that in the real world? And that was the sort of the switch, the sort of moment where I could take that device and put it in the real world and what would happen. And it came from that, really. It was not being able to travel and wanting to travel. And that's why first, maybe third of the book is just me showing my holiday photos. It's like, these are all the places I've been that I would like to be able to go, but I can't because it's COVID and there's lockdown. So I was traveling vicariously through the writing at that point. And it was a bit of a release from the day job and everything else that was going on. That's where it came from.
So it's a COVID book then, is it?
Yeah. It was. I'd had an agent. So I'd been signed with an agent for a couple of years just at the start of COVID. And the book that I'd signed with him for didn't sell. It's that sort of thing where he sends it to publishers and nobody's interested or interested enough. So I was trying to write something else, and I gave him a list of ideas, and this was one of them. And he said, write that one because it's a book about books, and publishers and readers love books about books. So I wrote it during COVID, during my evenings when I wasn't working and we couldn't do anything else, couldn't go anywhere. I would write that instead. So yeah, absolutely a COVID book, but not about COVID, helpfully.
No,
cheers.
No COVID in it at all, is there? There isn't. Tell me then, so it's been, when did you begin it then? When was the start of it?
So I wrote it over about 4 months in, what year are we now? This is 2024, 2021. It was like March, July, something like that, yeah.
400 pages in 4 months.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. That was 4 months, and then it went to the publishers, and obviously
there's an editing process, but that's pretty full on, given that you're also doing a full-time job.
It was quick, yeah. But I will say again, it was COVID, so I wasn't doing anything else. I had nothing else to do. I would work.
You weren't watching binging box sets or anything?
No, but I can type fast, which helps. So I can do 3,000 words in, you know, an hour or two. So as long as I know what I'm writing, it can be done quite quickly. But that was fast one. It's unusually fast to do it that quickly.
Is that simply because, you know, the idea was really kind of grabbed you?
I think it did write itself, so it came quite naturally. But I think it was also because I had an agent, and I wanted to prove my worth. I wanted to get. I'd gone through the thing. Oh, I've got an agent. I'm in the special place now. Everything's going to be great. And then my book didn't sell. First book I wrote. So I said, I don't want to lose my agent. I've got to perform. So I felt a bit of. There wasn't pressure, but I felt a desire to demonstrate that I could write something. And when my agent read the first 20,000 words, he said, "Oh, this is it. We're going to sell this. How quickly can you do it?" So there was a bit of a drive from him to do it because he wanted to sell it after the summer, before there's all these things in the book world, the Frankfurt Book Fair, and you know all these other things that you wanted to deal with. So there was a bit of a, not a pressure, but he was like, "Oh, how are you getting on? Have you finished it?" So there was a bit of a drive to do it, and being able to type fast, and actually, helpfully, knowing it kind of came quite easily, which is not always the way with books. Sometimes it takes a long time, but that one, it's almost like it was waiting there to be written.
Really, that's interesting. I mean, I don't know. Has anyone read the book yet? What's the sense of most of you? Right. Listen, no spoilers today. We will not be telling you anything that happens in it. Well, that's interesting because it's such a intricately structured book. There's, you know, there's a wonderful satisfaction at the end when you pull everything together. And I had the sense that, I just had this vision of you with a wall full of, right, you know, those kind of yellow post-it stickers saying, right, this goes to there, this goes to there. One of those kind of murder map things.
Yeah.
Was there a bit of that going on?
No, but you're not the first person to say that. I mean, it sounds a bit trite, but I just made it up as I went along.
Really?
Yeah, I just made it up as I went along, and there's a bit of a masochist in me where sometimes I'll get to the end of a chapter and I'll say to myself, "What would surprise me if it happened now?" And then I'll write that, and then I have to work out the next day how to make that thing work. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. So there is, without being spoiled about it, there is a bit of sort of circularity in it, things that are explained later, that happened earlier. And I could do that because I had a sense that some of that was going to happen, and I kind of worked out as I went. And other times I'll just go back and like leave little things that then would pay off later. So there was a bit of writing it backwards and forwards rather than just writing it straight through.
Did you know where it ended?
No. When I started writing the book, I had literally the first scene, the very first scene in the book, the first chapter. And there's one chapter about three quarters of the way through the book, or right at the very end of the book, actually, that I knew I wanted to do. And those were the only two things I had. And it, like I say, everything else I made it up as I went.
You winged it.
And there was whole characters and stuff that just appeared as I was writing it. And so, yeah, I started. This doesn't always work. Sometimes this is a nightmare. But this one, it worked really well. I just wrote it and it came.
And was there a eureka moment where you just something just slipped into place?
There was so there's a character in the book called Drummond Fox, who's a very handsome Scotsman, not based on me in any way. And he has this library of magical books. And for a long time when I was writing the book, and I was probably about three quarters of the way through it, I didn't know what his motivation was. So I knew I needed this sort of character, like the sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi character, that you've got the women who discover the book and they don't know this world, and he knows the world. So he's the sort of for the audience as well, he introduces the world to them. So I knew I needed that sort of device, but I couldn't work out why he was there and doing the things he was doing. And I had this whole other plot that was about him trying to fix something that had happened in the past with one of the magical books. And it just didn't feel right. It felt very political and very, this is sort of fairy tale-ish.
Yes.
And I was about three quarters of the way through it, and I knew it wasn't right, but I was persistently writing it. I'm going to write this thing, I'm going to write it. And then we were out walking the dogs one day, and the idea just came to me about, as you say, he's got this library that's in the shadows, and that's his motivation. He's trying to get back to that library. And so that was probably the true eureka moment of, it all makes sense now. And some of the things I'd written earlier, which didn't make sense otherwise, with that sort of slight tweak, the jigsaw puzzle pieces fit more properly.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to. Are you a puzzle man? Are you kind of someone who does crosswords and everything?
I have done crosswords. I think I like the idea of puzzles more than I tolerate doing them.
Right, okay.
I think I go into them with good intentions and I just get annoyed. Jigsaws I would always like. Yes. But anything that actually properly taxes my brain, I'm too lazy. Oh, I just can't be bothered. Just what's the answer? Look at the answers.
You're not Ludwig. Have anyone been watching Ludwig on the TV?
No, but I went to watch it, yeah.
Well, listen, we're going to talk about some of the characters there. You mentioned Drummond, and Drummond is the guy with the castle in the shadows and the library's inside the castle. And we'll get to the magic books, that is a spoiler, but we'll get back to that in a moment. I want to talk about Cassie and Izzy to begin with, and tell us a little bit about them, introduce them to our audience.
Okay, so the main character, or one of the main characters, is a woman called Cassie. And at the start of the book, she's living a quiet life in New York City. She's working as a bookseller. She's a woman who has got a lot of grief in her background, I suppose. She was raised by her grandfather, and her grandfather died 10 years ago at sort of a comparatively young age. And that was the only parent figure she's ever really known. So she's carried that grief, and she's sort of become introverted. So like a lot of book people, books are her world. She finds comfort in escaping into books, and she does that rather than having to deal with the real world, really. So she spends her life working in a bookshop in New York, and she lives with her flatmate and friend, Izzy, who is, I suppose, quite a different character, a contrasting character. So they're good friends, and they met both working in the bookshop, but Izzy now works in a department store. And Izzy's a much more sort of glamorous, vivacious, outgoing sort of person. She wanted to be an actress, and she moved to New York to be an actress and realised that she probably wasn't good enough. So, but she now works in the department store, and she likes, you know, going out and drinking and having a good time, whereas Cassie's a sort of introvert. So they both share a flat, but their lives are so busy that they only occasionally sort of cross paths. But although they're very different people, I think they've got a very good friendship. They both there's a sort of bond there.
Yeah.
And sometimes you find that in life, you find somebody who's just completely different to you, but there's a bond that's not just about you liking the same thing. So they're the two characters, and then Cassie discovers this book, and then a bit of the tension comes from Izzy being worried about the book and how she's using it, but Cassie, because it's a book you can literally escape into, you know, want to use it to escape and travel the world sort of thing. So that drives a bit of the tension at the start, is that Cassie being a bit excited and Izzy being a bit worried about what the book means and Cassie getting taken away by it.
Yeah. You've already mentioned Drummond Fox. I do have to let's talk about the bad guys, or bad man and bad woman, I think it's fair to say, who are proper evil, I think, in this.
Yeah. So there's two sort of antagonists. There's a character called Hugo Barbary, who in this book, the Book of Doors is one of several different magical books that exist in the world. And some people know about them, and so there's people who covet them and hunt them, and Hugo Barbary is one of these people who's for power or for other reasons. He's trying to capture all the books, and he's got a few books of his own, but he's basically a sociopath. You know, he enjoys causing pain to people, and he's the initial antagonist we see. But then there's another person, person just known as the woman, who's I suppose a more of a force of nature. She sort of just sweeps in, causes destruction, doesn't say very much, nobody really knows who she is, and she too is trying to gather the books. And I suppose, actually, going back to the COVID thing, in retrospect, she's probably a bit of a sort of a manifestation of COVID, this sort of force of nature.
Yes.
Everybody's aware of it's out there in the world, and it just sweeps in and destroys things and disappears again. So I wasn't thinking that at the time, but after the fact, looking back, I can see there's a bit of that in it. So she's the sort of the big baddie. Hugo's the minor baddie, and she's the big baddie.
She is also able to kill people in the most malign and inventive ways. And I did worry slightly, Gareth, about your own dark side, frankly, reading it.
So I'll apologise if anybody who's not read this and who's planning to read it, there's a bit of a story about that. So when the book was sold, it was sold to the US and the UK, two different publishers, and some of those scenes that you're talking about weren't in it. And then my UK publisher said to me, "Oh, we need more evil. We need to show how evil, show us how evil the woman is." And I was like, "Right, I'm going to show you how evil she is." So there's a few. There's not a lot through it, but I grew up reading a lot of horror, so I have sort of horror stuff in my back pocket. And so there's a few scenes dotted through it, maybe two or three scenes dotted through it, where just release the tension a little bit by showing how horrible she is.
She's very horrible, yeah. It reminded me, actually, I remember John Gordon Sinclair wrote a crime novel, and, you know, it's Gregory, and he had this scene in the book. It was so malign, and so I had to go, you know, I thought, Gregory's written this. This is terrible. And there's a bit of that in this, because the rest of it is just such a lovely book, and then suddenly, terrible moments.
And I've seen some people don't like it because it is in the UK in particular, it's marketed quite cosy. You know, it's a cosy adventure and books and libraries and friends. And then there's a sudden left turn and there's a horrible scene. And we were at a book club last night in Falkirk, and it's not the first time it's been said to me, but there's a scene near the start where the woman does something. And this woman at the book club said, "I just can't stop thinking about it. It's just horrible. I just can't stop thinking about it." I'm like, "Oh, sorry. I'll fix it, promise." And a few people have said that to me about that particular scene. I can't stop thinking about it. And it's not graphic or anything, but what happens is horrible. So I've promised a few people that if I write a sequel, I'll fix it. I'll fix it in the sequel.
Well, listen, you mentioned there are other magic books. So we should talk about some of them. So this is the Book of Doors, obviously. But what other books are there in the world, in this fantasy world?
So there's quite a few. So
have you got a number of how many in your head?
No. So as I was writing it, I would just... Sometimes it was not to sort of reveal the magic behind the curtain. Sometimes I would just create a book because I needed to get out of a plot hole. So I don't know what to do. I'll just create a magic book. That'll solve it. I'm being slightly silly, but there was a bit of that. There were books that I needed to allow certain things to happen that I wanted to happen. So, for example, Drummond has this Book of Shadows where he can hide in the shadows. And he's been on the run for 10 years at the start of the book, and he's trying to evade other people. So he uses the Book of Shadows to hide. He also carries a Book of Memory so he can affect people's memories. And he talks about using it with somebody who's got Alzheimer's to bring back their memories and give them a bit of relief. But he can also use it to make people forget things. So again, if he's trying to hide, he can make people forget that he was over there. The horrible man, Hugo Barbary, has a Book of Pain, which you can use...
Particularly nasty, that one, yes.
I mean, it could be nasty, but you can use it to relieve pain as well. So it's just about giving you control over pain. You can cause pain, or you can take pain away from people. And one of the fun things about the book is, or the story is, coming up with these books, but then trying to think about interesting ways to use them. So a Book of Pain, you know, a horrible person can use it to cause pain, but could use it in a different way. Could you use it to make the world a better place? So there's some of that goes on in the book as well. Is I've been asked in the past which books are evil and which books are good, and I don't think any book is good or evil. I can't think of a book in the story that is just absolutely evil. I think it's who's using them. You know, they're just devices for power, and who's using them will depend whether they're for good or for evil.
Yeah. I think Drummond has 17 in the castle, is that right?
Yeah, 17 in his library. Not all of them are named, and there are other books out there in the world as well waiting to be discovered, and other book hunters carrying books. So it's never made clear how many books there are. Specifically.
That does suggest a sequel might be a possibility.
Yeah, it does.
Fair enough. We'll not go there.
We'll be back with more from Gareth Brown in a moment, but now let's take a trip to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
New from Bloomsbury, we have The Instrumentalist by Harriet Constable. Dusk, and the Maragona bell tolls in the Piazza San Marco.
the chimes shiver out from the bronze mouth, glide over the domed roof of the basilica, lick the cockles lining the mud-drenched canal, and filter through a gap between pavement and wooden door. Behind it, a girl standing in a narrow, dimly lit passageway looks up. To some, the bell indicates the time. To others, it notes holy days, gatherings of the council, public executions. But to her, it is a signal that she and her fellow workers may take to the streets for the night. Now is the time for business.
Venice, 1704. In this city of glittering splendour, desperation and destitution are never far away. At the Ospedale della Pietà, abandoned orphan girls are posted through a tiny gap in the wall every day. 8-year-old Anna Maria is just one of the 300 girls growing up within the Pietà's walls, but she already knows she's different. Obsessive and gifted, she's on a mission to become Venice's greatest violinist and composer, and in her remarkable world of colour and sound, it seems like nothing will stop her. But the odds are stacked against an orphan girl, so when the maestro selects her as his star pupil, Anna Maria knows that she must do everything in power to please this difficult, brilliant man. But as Anna Maria's star rises, threatening to eclipse that of her mentor, the dream she has so single-mindedly pursued is thrown into peril.
Dawn approaches, a thick fog snaking down the canal. She just has to keep walking. Just keep walking, and this thing will stay quiet. She reaches an opening where ornate buildings with peaked windows back onto the jade green canal. 4 steps lead down to the water. It laps against them enticingly. Come to me, it calls. Come to me. The water is cool, but even this early on a spring morning it's refreshing. She clutches the creature to her body and wades in deeper. Deeper. This. Of course this is the solution. It is so peaceful, so calm. The girl leans back and, simple as breathing, sinks both their bodies beneath the surface.
The Instrumentalist by Harriet Constable is read by Amelia Clark and runs for 10 hours 56 minutes.
Also new in the library is the latest in the Jonas Merrick spy series by Gerald Seymour, The Best Revenge.
He was, by nature, an optimist. He believed pretty much all that he was told by those with superior qualifications to his own. He trusted implicitly the claims made by those who were senior in rank to him. The creed of thinking the best of others, in particular those who held high office in the party and of being loyal to their wisdom, had assured his advancement in the military.
On the Mongolian steppes, a general in the People's Liberation Army stakes his career and his life on a GPS-free missile guidance system that would change the balance of power on the battlefield. In Bath, a young Chinese woman has secured the affections of a young brainiac working on that very problem. In Leamington Spa, a deep cover operative has given himself away. And in London, Jonas Merrick watches all, assessing, planning. A moment perhaps for him to strike a blow to China's espionage network in the UK. One thing he does not see, however, is in Moscow, an order given. Bring me his head.
At the young age of 37 years, Zhang Dong wore a full colonel's insignia on the epaulets of his uniform. Because of the importance of the occasion, his uniform, tunic and trousers, had been immaculately cleaned and pressed. His medal ribbons were bright on the camouflage patterns over his chest. Not that he had actually seen combat himself. A voice, pent up with excitement, boomed out from loudspeakers. It had been launched, was on its way, and would strike the target in some 2 minutes. The announcement caused a ripple of steadily mounting excitement behind him. He was at the Zhurye training base of the People's Liberation Army, close to the boundary line beyond which lay Inner Mongolia, the autonomous region of northern China. The chattering grew in intensity on the terraced seats of the viewing stand for distinguished guests and commanders drawn from the army, the air force, and the navy. It was his nature to be confident. A good servant of the party would not entertain the contagion of doubt. Before the guests had gone to their lunch, in a marquee shaded from the bright sunshine beating back from the desert surface, he had addressed them. A simple message.
The Best Revenge, Juris Medic Book 4 by Gerald Seymour, is read by Ben Allen and runs for 16 hours and 52 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library. RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to Gareth Brown and Teddy Jameson on The Book of Doors.
I mentioned in the introduction that time travel is part of the story, and I don't want to kind of go into how it happens and what happens, but you have a really interesting theory, or one of your characters has a really interesting theory in the book, which suggests that, yes, you can go back in time, but you actually can't change anything. Nothing will change because you've already been back in time, which I think is fascinating. It's kind of like a counterintuitive to every time travel story.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going back to the Paleolithic era, killing a bug, and you know dinosaurs rule the earth or something like that. So
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that thinking behind that.
Yeah, so the book that I'd signed with my agent for that didn't sell was a book all about time travel, because I like time travel stuff, and there's not that many really good time travel books out there, I think, and that's partly because a lot of people don't like them, but I think they're quite hard to do as well because it just gets complicated by definition. So I'd written this book about time travel, which I loved and my agent loved, but the publishers found it was either too sci-fi for them or not sci-fi enough, depending on what kind of publisher they were. So it kind of sat in between. So I still had that sort of time travel-y thing in my bones. I was like, oh. So when I was writing this, there's a sort of development in the plot that allows time travel to happen. And I can't remember why I ended up with that model of time travel. So there's sort of two models of time travel. There's the one where you can go back and change things and everything, you know, the whole future's changed as a result. A bit like the Back to the Future thing, if you know Back to the Future. And this model is the one you describe, where you can go back and anything you do has already happened because it's in the past and it's contributed to the future that you came from. So it doesn't mean there's no free will or anything. You are doing stuff, but you're not changing anything in the future because that future follows the past, so to speak. Makes sense in my head, honest. But what that does is, and a lot of people have seemed to have responded quite well to this, I think people struggle more with the time travel where everything changes. I think people, last night we were having this conversation with the book club, people like the fact that somebody goes back in time and they do things and it explains things that happen. And that's kind of what I've done in this book. I like it in TV shows or in books when you see something and you think you understand it and then maybe 50 pages later or two episodes later, there's another explanation and you see there's a deeper meaning there or there's something you didn't quite understand and it makes you want to go back and watch it again or read it again because you can see. So this I've done a bit of that in this where we see events, but then later in the book we see a different explanation for those events or we understand them from a different way. And I quite enjoy that, seeing things from two different perspectives. And time travel allows you to do that. It allows you to say, well, what was really going on was this, and you just didn't know about it at the time.
Yeah. I want to travel back in time in your own time and tell us about the young Garth Brown, and you know, you say, I think you've said that you were writing from an early age. So, you know, when did the reader become the writer?
I wasn't actually much of a reader when I was younger, surprisingly.
So it's not the door of books for you.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't one of these people who always had my nose in a book. I mean, I did read when I was younger, but it was mostly the things teachers told me I had to read. And it was only when I was a teenager and one of my friends at school said, "You need to read this book by this guy Stephen King." Stephen King was the sort of gateway drug. And it was this book, Christine, which is a preposterous book about a haunted car. But this haunted car allows a sort of spotty teenage boy to become attractive to women and popular. And as a spotty teenage boy at the time, I was like, oh, this is fun. And I started just reading lots of Stephen King books, and I thought, oh, I love horror books. I mean, I didn't really love horror books. What I liked was a good writer, and Stephen King, whatever he writes, is a good writer.
Yeah.
So that was sort of my gateway drug at sort of 13, 14. I only really properly started reading, or reading in a way where I thought, I want to do this. I want to be able to tell stories like this. I can't remember exactly when I decided I wanted to be a writer, but it was around that time when I just read like my first one or two books. Before that, I'd like wanted to be a film director or something. So I'd always wanted to do something with stories.
Stories was the key.
And film director sounded like dead glamorous and cool and everything. And I didn't even know what a film director was, but I knew I wanted to do it. But it's funny, I was not that long ago, I was looking through some report cards from primary school. And one of my, I think it was primary 3 or primary 4 report cards said, had a comment about very good at creative writing. And I have no memory of this at all. I don't even remember doing creative writing in primary 4, but there must have been something there that a teacher would spot it and comment it on a report card. So maybe I always had some sort of aptitude, wherever that came from, and I just needed the books to tell me this is what I wanted to do. And having a really good book, having a really good experience, and that sort of thing where you can't put a book down and you're annoyed when you have to go and do something else, that's the sort of feeling I wanted to capture. I wanted to give people that feeling that here's something that you can't put down, and it takes you away from any troubles you've got. You know, you can lose yourself in the book, a bit like Cassie, I suppose, losing yourself in books. I wanted to give people that.
Well, yes, I mean, we should talk about some of the books that are mentioned in the novel. Kind of Monte Cristo being one of them. Yeah. Then that's not Stephen King, but I guess it's similar in a sense. It's a popular
it's not Stephen
writer.
King. Popular writer. So yeah, I went to university and did literature at university because I wanted to be a writer, and I thought, well, I need to do a literature degree and then become a writer. You know, that was the order. I thought, do a literature degree, write, and become published by 26. That's the way it happens. I actually didn't really enjoy studying literature. I found I like reading books, but I didn't enjoy sitting around talking about them with other people and trying to take them apart. I find myself getting irritated by it. I said, well, the author wasn't doing that. I wouldn't be doing that if I was him. And, you know, putting all these... And maybe the authors were doing it, but I just found it was a bit too abstract for me. So I love reading books. I don't so much love doing sort of literary analysis. But, yeah, I read all the serious books, all the grown-up books like Count of Monte Cristo. And I love Count of Monte Cristo because it's essentially just a really good revenge story.
Yeah, it is.
It's actually quite modern in some of the way it's written, other than the big bit in Rome in the middle, which goes on for ages. But the sort of the revenge bit's really good. But some of the other like classic books, like things like Moby Dick, I just hated. You know, there's books that I just couldn't... And I can understand intellectually why it's good and what it's doing, all this, but it's just a tedious thing to read. So yeah, I read all the serious books, but after I finished university, then I just started reading, you know, crime books and horror books and just popular fiction that you'd buy in airports sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That was the stuff I was just inhaling. And so that's definitely informed what I write. I've always wanted to write, as I say, something page-turnery, something that people can't put down.
Well, what was the very first thing you wrote and what age were you when you started?
Very first thing I wrote that I can remember writing, I remember as a teenager on my mum and dad's big steam-powered Amstrad word processor trying to write a novel when I was like 13 or 14. One of these big things, little black and green screens.
Yep.
You know, didn't have all colours, it was like CFAX. And I was writing, it was probably more of a novella then, it was probably about 50, 60,000 words. Trying to write something then.
Like you wrote 50 or 60,000?
Yeah, I just wrote it, and it was like just a silly sort of fantasy thing about a man who ends up in a fantasy world. And after that, I was always, because I was convinced, well, part of it was I just didn't want to get a job. I was like, well, if I write, I'll never have to work. It'll be brilliant. I can be famous.
That's worked out well,
40 years later. But I just loved it. I think being quite introverted, I just liked sitting in the room and making up stories. And I never really wanted to write short stories. I mean, I did write a few short stories when I was younger, but I always wanted to go to the big thing. I wanted to write a novel, maybe a proper writer and write a big novel. And I think it was partly also because short stories don't make any money, but novels you can make money with. So I was always even thinking, Kenny Scotsman, I was thinking, well, I need to make money as well. So, but I was just modelling myself on like the Stephen King sort of thing. Yeah. I want to be a big author and have big books, big thick books that you can, you know, hold doors open with. Right from a teenager, my ambitions were much better than my abilities, and I was trying to write big books back then.
So what has kept you writing? Because you have gone in, you've worked, you know, and presumably that kind of cuts into your writing time. What's kept you writing over those years? And presumably there were a few rejections, I guess.
I mean, I was writing pretty consistently over that period of time, all through my life. So I took my first job in the civil service thinking I'll just get this to pay the bills until I'm published and rich. And I was in the civil service for 20 plus years. And I've moved into the NHS in the last few years. And there were a few years where I didn't write so much just because the work was so demanding. And you spend a day at work on a computer and you don't really want to come home and then spend 2 hours on the computer again. So it was just hard. But I always was annoyed with myself if I wasn't working on something. I always felt I was good enough to be published at some point if I kept trying. I'd had signs of progress along the way. So when you send things out to literary agents, you normally just get a no thanks sort of standard letter, but I'd had a few responses that were more personalised, that, you know, the writing's good but nobody's buying this sort of thing, so I was like, oh, that's good. And then I met a literary agent in, I think, 2001, something like that, about something I'd written, and they were like, oh, it's good but it's not quite right. So I was seeing sort of signs of incremental progress. I never just hit an absolute wall, so there was enough sort of incentive and belief to keep writing. And I think actually it was COVID and ended up working at home and not commuting and having more time. It just gave me more space in a sort of condensed way to do it quite quickly. And I'd had the literary agent before that, so the thing I'd written previously, I'd written over a few years, that got me the literary agent. But what COVID gave me was the space to then respond to what he was saying and give him things. So I think trying to be a published writer is often a persistence game. The longer you keep trying, the better you become. If you're doing it over years and years, you become better. But You can't control so much of the publishing world. You can't control who's going to see your book, what mood they're going to be in, and whether they're going to like it or not, whether they've got space on the list. So what you can control is just how long you keep trying, keep having a go at it, and the quality of the thing you produce. So the longer you do it, the more likely you are, I think, to get somewhere. So that was my thinking, is I'll just keep going, I'll keep going, I'll keep going.
How many finished novels have you got in the cupboard at home?
I honestly can't remember. I mean, I was writing full novels as a sort of as a teenager, as I
really?
Said.
Yeah. Wow.
Not very good ones, but I was writing really bad novels and sending them off in the days we had to put things into brown paper envelopes and post them and wait 3 months for a reply. Because now you can email it all, but you still wait 3 months for a reply. but I have, I mean, even just over the period that I signed with my agent, I'd written something like 4 novels. I wrote a novel after this. I wrote a novel between the one he signed me for and this one, which, clever me, I wrote a thing about a pandemic, and he was like, nobody's going to buy a book about a pandemic. Right now. And so I wrote that one. And then after, I had a 2-book deal with the Book of Doors, so I had to write a second book. So I wrote one after that one, just because I wanted to write it. I need to get this contractual obligation off my back. And I wrote something that was awful. And he sort of gave me a sideways look saying, I don't think this is your second book. So I had to write another one. So I've written, even since that, I've written 2 books, and I'm sort of halfway through a third one now. So just because I want to get the money, I want them to pay me for the second book.
What was it like how did you get the call knowing this has been accepted and someone's going to publish it? And what was that like for you, given all that back history of it?
I mean, it was a sort of a life dream fulfilled sort of thing. So my agent, he put the book out on a Thursday. So what happens is an agent will, a bit like when I'm trying to go to an agent, I'll send it out to agents. He puts it out to editors and publishers. So he has a list of editors that he wants to send it to. And he has a sub-agent who does it for agents overseas. So he put it out on the Thursday, I think it was, and he said he was going away for a holiday for a week. He was going to a friend's wedding in Italy. So I put it out, and I'll touch back in with you when I get back. And fully expecting nothing would happen, because in the publishing industry, it can be months before you hear anything. Yeah. The next day, we were having phone calls, and then he was flying out to Italy. And then for the rest of the week, his holiday was ruined, frankly. He was taking phone calls, people were chasing him down. He was supposed to be at this wedding and he was taking calls, and his girlfriend was furious at him, and it's all fault for putting it out just for his holiday. But it went out on the Thursday, and I think it sold in the UK the following Thursday. The deal was agreed, and in Germany that week, and then it sold in the US the following week as well. So, and then I think we got the Netherlands shortly after that as well. So we had about 3 or 4 deals within about 2 weeks, which is pretty rare.
Indeed,
in this day and age.
Yeah.
And I think we're up to now about 22 territories, I think. So we just got France, and we've got crazy things like the Arabic World, World Rights Have Sold, South Korea has bought it recently, Greece has bought it, Turkey. So most of Europe has basically got it, and North America's got it. And the only place I haven't got yet that I really want is Japan. I'd love a Japanese edition, but that might not happen. So it's done really well, and it was... it was like a life-changing moment. The sale in the UK was for a big amount of money, but the sale in the US kind of dwarfed it, because the US is just a huge market. And my agent only ever calls me if it's like really good news. So he phoned me up and said, "Are you sitting down?" Sort of thing. This is the sale for the US and the amount of money, and it's life-changing amounts of money. So it was like, but of course, there's always a string attached. In the publishing industry, you get paid over like 4 or 5 years. It's not like they just give you a big massive dump truck of money. Like, there's milestones every sort of, you sign, then you get the publication, then you get the paperback publication, then you get the acceptance. So it's over about 4 or 5 years, so it looks like a huge amount of money. So I keep saying, I can pay off my mortgage, but I'm still working because I can't pay off my mortgage yet, because they haven't given me the money yet. So it's all still a bit abstract, but it's amazing. It's been a life-changing sort of experience over the last year.
Yeah, 2 years. That's brilliant. Well, listen, you mentioned earlier Cassie and her grandfather, and I think that's one of the most powerful parts of the book. It's a very, very moving sequences in that. And I'm wondering, obvious question, did you draw on your own life for things like this?
No. So I've had a very dull life. I've had no real trauma to speak of.
Well, lucky you, I would say.
Both my parents are still alive. I've had, obviously I've had grandparents and died and stuff, but sure. I've not had any great trauma in the way that Cassie has. And the stuff with Cassie and her grandfather was actually the stuff I was probably most trepidatious about writing, because it's all about these weird things called emotions. And as a sort of dead inside Scotsman, I kind of struggle with that. So I had to do this scene where, I'll try not to be spoiler, but basically Cassie goes to meet her grandfather. And it's a very emotional scene. I was like, I don't know how to write this. How do you have emotions? What does it look like when somebody has emotions? I don't really know. So I had to use my imagination as a writer and think what it would be like to have emotions as somebody who doesn't have them, obviously.
Well, you did pretty well, I have to say. I think you managed that. Well, there's an interesting thing, though. I mean, I'm sure there are bits of this book that you can see yourself in. Novels are exposing in a way. You just find yourself writing and it's from your experience, just inevitably.
Yeah,
so I mean, I'm just wondering how you feel about that, being out in the world.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing about it that makes me cringe or anything. There's nothing that I think I've revealed, or if I've revealed things that are too awkward, they're very well hidden, so nobody knows them. But there's definitely bits of meaning. So Cassie just being essentially an introvert and loving to be in books and not having to deal with the real world. I hate having to deal with the real world,
Why he's at a book festival.
That's why I'm at a book. I mean, I can do it. I think I'm a high-functioning introvert. I can manage dealing with the real world, but it does stress me out. So just to be able to sit in a room and read a book, that's me and Cassie. But the travel stuff as well, Cassie does a lot of travelling.
Yeah.
And she travelled around Europe after her grandfather died, and I've travelled around Europe with friends. All the places that she goes are places that my wife and I have been. So that's very much drawn from the love of cities. She loves cities, I love cities. A few of the more critical reviews I've seen. There's somebody on Goodreads who said, there's too many croissants in it.
Yeah.
Too many croissants. This author is obsessed with croissants. And I was like, maybe I do. Maybe I have got too many croissants in it. And there's a few scenes where they're eating croissants and they keep talking about, oh, there's a croissant, really nice. And I was like,
well, they do, yeah. They sound very nice croissants, I have to say.
I was like, maybe,
but in Paris, you should be good croissants.
Well, but maybe I'm just too focused on the cakes and the biscuits. And then Drummond goes to his house and he's got ice cream and cake and biscuits. And I'm like, I need to think about my... And a few people have said that. This person needs to think about their diet. So maybe that's the thing that's been revealing.
Well, exactly, yeah. So the book starts in York in this incredible bookshop. And I want to ask you about bookshops and their importance or otherwise to you, because it just seems like you're someone who likes a good bookshop.
Yeah, I love a good bookshop. I mean, for a long time I wasn't going to bookshops very often, not because I didn't want to, just because it wasn't convenient and I can press a button on my phone and get a book delivered to the door by the evil empire. But I love bookshops, and we live very close to Edinburgh, and Edinburgh's just a great place for bookshops now, and particularly the last few years. So they've always had endless number of Waterstones, it seems, but they now have like Toppings Booksellers, which is a lovely bookshop, and they've got lots of independent bookshops, the Golden Hair Books and Edinburgh Bookshop. So it's just a lovely place to go, and we go in quite often and just walk around with the dogs and pop into the bookshops. So I love bookshops, and I love, every time I'm in a bookshop, I try and buy a book to help the bookshops, because I like the fact that most bookshops pay taxes, whereas the evil empire doesn't, all that kind of stuff. But bookshops are, particularly now, I think, when bookshops are having to diversify, and they're often like cafes and they sell gifts and other things. So they're just nice places to be.
Yeah.
Booksellers, and haven't had an experience with booksellers over the course of the journey of the Book of Doors, they're all lovely. I've not met a bad bookseller yet. They're all lovely people. So it just seems to be a place that draws the right sort of people together, I think, bookshops.
As a former bookseller, I love to hear that. That's great. Yeah, exactly. What is it when someone says Gareth Brown author now? Yeah. What does that feel like?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I would say I've always been an author. I've just never been published. So there is a difference between writing and being published.
Published author, then. Gareth Brown, published author.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because it is... Maybe it's just I'm not very sentimental, but it's always been a life goal to be published. Like, my whole life, it's like, I always say I wanted to be a writer, even though I was doing a proper grown-up day job. And then I've got there, and, you know, lots of people who write and publish books haven't had the experience I've had. I've been really, really lucky. But I've kind of just focused on the next book. I'm kind of immediately onto where I need to write the next book. And because that's done quite well, I've got to live up to that now. So there's almost like a pressure that comes with I've delivered. So, you know, I've got a second book to deliver. Is it going to be as good? Are they going to like it? Are they going to hate it? Are they just going to say nice things to me because they've got a contract with them? And then what after the second book? Am I going to get another contract? So it immediately goes into that sort of businessy, processy sort of brain. But I haven't really managed yet, I think, to stop and... I don't think I've really absorbed it yet. I don't think I've really stopped and sat down and really contemplated what's happened. I kind of don't go near it. I kind of just exist and let it happen.
You must have given yourself a day to enjoy the fact.
The publication week was nice. Yeah. So we went down to London and we had a nice lunch with my UK publisher. And we went into Watson's in Piccadilly before it was official publication day, and they already had it on the shelf. And most of them had been sold, which was like, yes. So that's nice. And just travelling around randomly, we were in Malaysia and Singapore early in the year. And when we were flying back from Singapore, and it's W.H. Smith, which amazed me. And W.H. Smith in Singapore Airport, it was on the shelf there as number four. I don't think it was number four bestseller. I think they just put it where the space is. But next to Stephen King and Jeffrey Archer, and I'm like, that's okay. Having a wee picture of me pointing at the book next to Stephen King, that's a nice moment. And even walking around Edinburgh and Toppings, I mean, this was published in February, and even just a few weeks ago, they had the book in the window. I don't know why, and I had to go in and sign a few copies. So even just seeing a book in the window next to like other big authors, that's quite a nice feeling as well. So those odd moments happen when it's sort of real for a moment. But then I just go back to the day job and thinking about what the next book will be, and the tyranny of day-to-day life gets in the way.
Well, indeed. I want to ask about that balance between the day job and the writer. I mean, are they complementary? Are they contrasting? Do they battle each other? How do you kind of juggle it?
Last year was hard. So because I've got a different publisher in the US and the UK, so they shared the edit up to a point, and then it goes into this sort of separate proofread copy edit stage. And... there was a point, I think, for about 6 months last year where I'd finished the edit on that, the proofreader, which is going through every page, and then the US came in later with their proofread, and I had to go through all of that, and I'd take account of the changes that I'd made to the UK one, and also I was trying to write the second book, and also doing the day job. That was... And the proofread thing is a real migraine-inducing thing where you get this document, and I'm comparing it to the UK one, and I've got to transpose, and then there's one on the screen as well. So that's hard, intense work. Oh, yeah. So I do a day of work, and then I try and do that for a few hours, and then I'd be thinking about what I need to write for the second book. So I don't think I could do that again. So I think I need, depending on what happens with the second book, and if I get third or fourth books, I need to work out whether I keep working or reduce my hours or do something else. I think the editing and writing two books is too much. Doing one book and working is just about okay because I can work and then I can do a few hours quite easily in the evening just making stuff up. But when you start getting into contractual deadlines and, you know, this copyright editor needs this and that, and you're actually working and it's like a job then, it's like a proper job, not just having fun and making up crazy stories after your day job, that's quite hard. So I think in the next year or so I'll need to work out what to do about that.
Oh, interesting. What do you think is the appeal of fantasy fiction? And it's interesting because it has kind of taken off, I think, relatively recently. I mean, obviously Game of Thrones and all those things, but I mean, you're doing more urban fantasy. But what do you think is the appeal for the reader?
So, not to undermine your question or anything, but I don't read a lot of fantasy, funnily enough.
Why are you writing it?
Well, it is fantasy, I suppose. I mean, the book club last night, people were saying, well, it's not fantasy because there's not a map at the front.
Well,
that's the definition of what a fantasy
is. It's just, yeah.
And there's no dragons and wizards and stuff. But it's basically it's magic in the real world.
Magic, yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's accessible fantasy. So I think some of the things that have driven fantasy in recent years is there's a few things. One is definitely the TV series. So things like Game of Thrones. I know people who'd never read fantasy who read Game of Thrones because they'd seen the TV series. And that's almost like a gateway then into other things. But they also have these, some of you will know, they have these subscription boxes, so things like Fairy Loot and I can't remember what the other one's called, but you sign up and basically they send you a box, they curate it and they send you a book every month.
Yes.
And that's driven huge sales. And so if you look at the Sunday Times bestsellers, quite often it's one of the things that's been in those boxes, because they'll sell 30,000 on publication week because they've got 30,000 people signed up. And to get on the Sunday Times bestsellers, you need to sell about 4,000, maybe 5,000, depending on the week. So when you've got these big Sarah J. Maas things or these that are in these boxes and they've got guaranteed 30,000, that's driven a lot of the market, I think. But there's a few big authors as well. Like Sarah J. Maas obviously has been huge. I've not read any of her, but it all seems to be sort of sex between elves and stuff. I don't understand it, but that seems to be quite a big thing.
Listen, whatever so you have you're into.
TV series, Game of Thrones, the sort of the publishing industry moving into those boxes, particularly in the fantasy market. And there is something as well, I think, about fantasy and sci-fi books that appeal to, because they do these special editions with the sprayed edges and the lovely yes. covers, and that appeals to book collectors. That world of fantasy and science fiction book readers seems to love, because you don't really get that in crime, and crime is by far the biggest genre. You don't get the special edition crime books with the sprayed edges of blood and everything. It's more fantasy, and so they do beautiful products yeah. beyond just the book itself. All that's helped as well. But maybe just people are discovering how fun fantasy books can be. Maybe yeah. it's just having a real growth spurt. And romanticism seems to be a big thing at the moment. People falling in love in fantasy it's, worlds, yes, which is great. Yes.
Yeah.
And they had the grimdark sort of before that, the really grim, miserable sort of fantasy. And then they've moved into the sort of cosy fantasy now as a thing as well, where people drinking coffee in fantasy worlds. All this kind of is fascinating how they're
eating croissants, perhaps.
Eating croissants, yeah. So there's opportunities.
Well, why do you? But what do you like writing? Or what is the kind of appeal for you as a writer? You know, rather than writing something in the yeah. real world.
I've written everything over the years. I started writing horror because I wanted to be Stephen King, and then nobody was buying horror, and then I just naturally started reading other sort of popular fiction like American thrillers. And so for a long time, I was trying to be a crime or thriller writer. But the problem is that there's so many people writing in the world of crime and thriller, and it's such a high watermark. I never really thought I could be as good as the best people in that world. I also find it quite samey. As much as I enjoy it, like I enjoy reading like a Michael Connelly or whatever it is, Ian Rankin, but you do know it's a repackaging of the same story every time. You're going back to it because it's the same story, because it's ticking the boxes. So I always wanted to write sort of with creative variety. So... as I say, the book I signed with my agent was a book exploring science fiction, exploring time travel in the real yeah. world. And that was sort of science fiction, but it was set in the real world a bit like this as well. So I think I like things that are in a recognisable world. And that's partly because it's more accessible to people. I think there are people who will just never read a fantasy book because or a science fiction book. But if it's set in the real world but has fantasy elements, and they call it the sort of magical realism, which is the posh word for fantasy in the literary yeah. circles, they call it magical realism, it's much more accessible, and it's more. There's people who will never go to a fantasy section in a bookshop, but if a book's on the table at the front and it's got fantasy elements and it's set in the real world, they might read it. And the publisher said that to me, is this the reason it's sold, I think, is because it's commercial, because you can draw in the fantasy readers, people can see magic in it, but you can also draw people in who are not traditional fantasy readers, who can see it's something in the real world and sort of a thrillery sort of feel to it with, you know, compelling events, but there just happens to be magical books. But even the magic as well, it's, you know, some fantasy books have these really complicated magical systems, we have all these rules, and, you know, this is just you've got a book and it does something. It's quite an easy concept to grasp. So yeah. I think I just like writing things that lots of people will read. I mean, it sounds a bit silly, but the more people who read it, the better, I think. So I try and consciously be commercial and try and tick lots of boxes for people. But I would write crime and thriller books if I could. I would still write science fiction. But I think I would always try and set it somehow in a recognisable world. Yeah. I wouldn't go to some... I mean, there are some science fiction books I love, but, you know, books that spend ages describing spaceships and guns and... well, aliens, that's not for me. I like it to be something recognisable that it helps you into the world when you start reading.
Yeah. I was very excited when I read that in the back that you were born in Falkirk.
All the best people were.
Well, this is my theory, is that Falkirk is the secret cultural capital of Scotland.
I can believe it. Yeah.
You think of... but you do have to bring in Grangemouth, and in your case, Bo Ness, it would appear as well. Yeah. But if we do that, it's a larger cultural area of Falkirk. We've got writers... like yourself, Alan Bissett, mm-hmm. Gordon Legg. You've got artists like Alan Davey and Elizabeth Blackadder. You've got musicians, Cocteau Twins, Arab Strap, etc., etc. Is there something? Well, listen, serious question. Is there something about that area, even if it's just, God, I've got to get away from this and do something creative, that kind of, do you think maybe helps creative people?
So in all seriousness, it's probably... So I grew up in Bo'ness, which is a few miles away from Falkirk, and there's probably a few things about that experience. One is Bo'ness had a fabulous library. So, it's one of the probably travesties of modern age that they don't have budget for good libraries anymore, but there's a really lovely library in Bo'ness Town Centre and an old building. Maybe it says something about Bo'ness, I don't know, we had a really big horror section, so I would go down there and rent books, and they had lovely librarians who would engage with you and talk to you. So that probably helped me when I was... And my parents would always take us down once a week and rent books, so that was there. But the other thing was Bo'ness, when I was growing up, was quite... Bo'ness was a mining town, and post-thatch and everything, it became quite post-industrial, and there was a lot of poverty. And it was not a place that really... Certainly my peers at school, anyway, it was not a place that embraced or celebrated academic success or even books to any real degree. It was a place of, you know, football and fights and drinks and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to go somewhere else. I didn't want to be part of that. So it did drive me away. It did drive me to go to university and dream of bigger things in different places. And maybe the books were part of that as well, sort of reading about different places and different worlds. So not that I had a traumatic childhood or anything, but I wanted something bigger and somewhere else. And I didn't want to be in... I would look around and see people who'd been in that town for their whole life. I'd grown up there and I ended up in the same jobs that their parents were in, and their children would end up in the same jobs. And that's fine for some people, but I didn't want that. I wanted to go out and see the world and do other things. So, and the books were an escape before I could physically escape, I suppose.
Yeah. That's why you've ended up in Fife.
That's why I've ended up in hundreds of miles away in Fife, in a similar post-industrial town.
Hey, I'm listening to the audio version read by Miranda Raisin.
Yeah.
Did you have a hand in the casting of her, and do you not fancy doing it yourself?
No, I wouldn't do it myself because it's a proper job, and there's accents and stuff, and I can barely do my own accent, never mind South African. Yes, so they sent me, for the audiobook, they sent me, here's some people we think would be quite good, and you go and listen to their samples. And Miranda, for me, because there's a lot of, well, there's Drummond Fox, who's Scottish in it, I wanted to check how good her Scottish accent was, because I know if a Scottish accent is rubbish, obviously, as we all would. And her Scottish accent was impeccable, and her French was brilliant, and she did American, and also there's a lot of Americans in the book. So she was the one we picked, and I was lucky enough, I got to go down and meet her. They recorded it in Penguin Towers, because it's a Penguin book, in London, and so she did it over 4 days, and it's just amazing. Like, she's a professional actress, so you'd expect it, but just sitting in the booth watching her, like, the sections with, like, two different American accents and then a South African accent and then a Scottish guy talking, and she just switches like this, and being able to keep track of who's doing what, and she would do, like, 8-hour sessions, so she would do over 48-hour sessions, so she'd be in the booth for, like, 2 hours, and she'd take a 10-minute break and get a cup of tea and do another, and it's just amazing. Like, it's a proper job, you know, doing that, and to be able to, because they have to do it as quickly as possible. You know, they don't want to spend years and years and years doing it. So, but she was really impressive, and hopefully she'll do book two as well, second book when that comes out. That'd be great.
Thank you all for coming today. I hope you've enjoyed this. Gareth's been great. Thanks to RNIB Connect Radio for sponsoring the event. I just wanted to say thank you all for coming, and would you please give the warmest of thank yous for Gareth.
Thanks once again to Gareth Brown and, of course, to Teddy Jameson. The Book of Doors is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as narrated by Miranda Raisin. And we'll be back with more from the Wigtown Book Festival at the same time next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.